Good evening. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, searchers for the missing Malaysian jet report more suspected black box signals. India begins its election, and Chinese censors block details about an environmental protest that turned violent. It's all ahead on VOA's Crossroads Asia. Australian and U.S. Navy officials say they have detected more acoustic signals that may belong to a black box from the missing Malaysia Airlines jet. But they're stressing that the airliner's location cannot be confirmed until wreckage from flight MH370 is spotted on the surface or under the Indian Ocean. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Authorities Monday say they are very encouraged, but remaining cautious amid the clearest indications yet of where the wreckage of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 could be. The best clues during the month-long search have been picked up by U.S. Navy black box detection equipment being towed by an Australian naval ship in deep waters more than 1,500 kilometers northwest of Perth, Australia. Retired Air Chief Angus Houston, the leader of the Australian team coordinating the international search effort, says the first detection of acoustic signals on a frequency of 37.5 kilohertz was held for 2 hours 20 minutes. The second detection on a return leg was heard for 13 minutes.
Significantly, this would be consistent with transmissions from both the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder. Clearly, this is a most promising lead.
A British naval vessel, the HMS Echo, is heading to an area where a Chinese patrol ship, the Haishun 1, using a hydrophone dangled over the side of the boat, detected acoustic pings Friday and Saturday, about 2 kilometers apart. Houston says the vessels are in a race against time to receive further underwater signals.
The life of the batteries must be getting somewhere close to the end of life. It's, 31 days? So we're already one day past the advertised shelf life. We hope that it keeps going for a little bit longer.
Royal Australian Navy Commodore Peter Levy says searchers hope to use equipment to begin exploring the ocean floor if they detect more of the suspected black box signals.
If they gain another acoustic event on that towed pinger locator, that will be the trigger at the moment to launch the autonomous underwater vehicle with a more accurate sonar and potentially camera for mapping and visually looking at the ocean floor.
In the area where the acoustic pings have been detected, the ocean floor is about 4,500 meters below the surface. That is the limit of the operating depth for the autonomous underwater vehicle. Officials caution it could be weeks or possibly months before anything is found at that depth over what is still a wide search area. Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 disappeared on March 8th during a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. The aircraft was carrying 239 people. Most of the passengers were Chinese. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Coming up, Afghanistan's presidential election is determined to be a success, but the results are uncertain. India, more than 800 million registered voters, many for the first time, are casting ballots today for seats in the 543-seat lower house of parliament. Voting in the world's largest democracy is spread out in 9 stages over 5 weeks. After 10 years in power, it appears that voters may be about to reject the Congress Party in favor of the Bharatiya Janata Party of controversial Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi, chief minister of Gujarat state in northwest India. Rahul Gandhi, political heir of the Nehru-Gandhi political dynasty, heads a ruling Congress Party criticized over corruption scandals and economic policies. In 2005, Mr. Modi was denied a U.S. visa for failing to halt religious riots in Gujarat state that left more than 1,000 people, mostly Muslims, dead. He was cleared of any wrongdoing in his handling of the 2002 riots, although critics say he did little to quell the unrest. U.S. Ambassador to New Delhi, Nancy Powell, who's announced her resignation, met with him in February. Kanti Prasad Bajpai of National University of Singapore tells VOA's Victor Beatty he's hopeful the election will be free and fair and nonviolent. He's also looking for signs of a strong voter turnout.
Early indications are from voter surveys and so on that as many as 70% of the electorate might come out and vote, and that would be a very, very high figure given the last 20, 25 years of elections. So I think voter participation is a second big hope, and I think we're going to see it. And thirdly, I think everyone's looking forward to a fairly clear result so that the country can get back to business as quickly as possible with no uncertainties about who's going to govern. And there's a big economic and social agenda ahead of the country. And so the election's important for putting in place stable governments.
If he wins, would Mr. Modi be a divisive figure?
For some people, he will be a divisive figure. Some Hindus who are more secular-minded certainly worry about him. There are people amongst some sections of the lower castes who are not very attracted to him, who see him as being more oriented towards the upper castes. Of course, minority voters, particularly Muslims in India, who are 12% of the electorate and concentrated in key northern states, they will worry about Mr. Modi as well.
There's going to be a big youth vote this time around. What do young people in India want?
You're right. I mean, 100 million new voters are coming into the election. So that means these are people between the ages of 18 and about 23 or 24. They're quite attuned to Modi, but also to other protest parties and movements against corruption and the downturn in the economy. So, of course, those are the two big things that young people will be looking for: clean government, effective government, and, of course, on the other side, good economic management and the restoration of economic growth. Which means, of course, jobs. Young Indians want jobs and good-paying jobs and interesting jobs. So I think corruption, but even more than that, economic growth and employment opportunities, that's what they'll be looking for.
Aside from the economy, what are the pressing domestic and foreign policy issues the new administration will have to grapple with?
There's always the question of managing the kind of ramshackle bureaucracy that's everywhere in India. So I think people want decisive and effective governance on the ground in areas that they deal with every day. There's also a great desire for investments in things like infrastructure, public health, in better education. And then, of course, on the internal security front, people want some breakthroughs in dealing with the Maoists in central India. They want a general sense of law and order. And on the foreign policy and international security front, I think most people would look for this government to continue the Manmohan Singh's government's record of stability with major regional partners and rivals, the smaller countries to be sure, but especially Pakistan and China. I think there the Manmohan Singh government has a pretty good record, and I don't think anyone's looking for anything very different. With the United States, I think in general the mood will be to try and bring the relationship back on the rails after a series of difficulties. And of course, there'll be some curiosity about how the United States and India get past the Modi problem. That is the issue of whether the United States will get down to business with Modi, given that the Americans have not given Modi a visa for the last 10 or 15 years.
That's Kanti Prasad Bajpai of the National University of Singapore. Australian National University South Asia analyst Raghbendra Jha does not view Mr. Modi as a divisive figure, even though critics say he will heighten the country's religious turmoil.
Mr. Modi was one of the most scrutinized politicians in India. He's had his background checked more thoroughly than I think almost any politician. And intra-community relations in Gujarat has been quite good. Since 2002, there have been no communal disturbances. Prior to 2002, there were several communal disturbances in Gujarat, and I believe that there is a fair bit of cooperation between the two communities.
For good or ill, he's been linked to the intercommunal violence that left many hundreds dead. Is that a fair assessment? Should he be linked to them or not?
In my view, it's really unfortunate that politics and religion get mixed together. And Mr. Modi, even if we go by your argument and assume that there is some connection, Hardly any major politician in India who has not fished in troubled waters, so far as this is concerned. So I think his links with the 2002 riots don't hold up to scrutiny, at least they don't hold up to legal scrutiny. And there is an emotive issue which is very hard to remove. But looking at newspaper reports, he has treated both communities quite fairly in Gujarat. They even have business relationships with each other, which is quite remarkable.
Raghavendra Jha says stabilizing the economy and controlling inflation will be the potential prime minister's top domestic priority. He says improving relations with India's neighbors China, Pakistan and Sri Lanka are on Mr. Modi's foreign policy to-do list. Jha says with Afghanistan having held a relatively peaceful election Saturday, Pakistan's own hope for stability rests with improved ties with New Delhi. Rajiv Biswas, chief economist at IHS Global Insight in Singapore, tells Victor Beatty with an estimated 150 million Muslims in India, a key test of a new government headed by Mr. Modi would be outreach efforts to avoid alienating this key constituency.
He has, during his campaign, emphasized that he wants a united approach and that he wants to particularly focus on alleviating poverty. And a large share of the Muslim community are relatively poor. So if he is successful in tackling some of the issues of poverty, the Muslim community would be a big beneficiary of this. There's a lot of hopes now riding on Modi winning office. Certainly, you know, much of big business, and I would say most of urban India, is very much in favor of him coming in, because I think people are disillusioned with Congress in the last 5 years in terms of their ability to deal with key issues such as high inflation, growth rates have slowed down considerably, and there's also a lot of concerns about other issues such as corruption in government. The Congress party's rolled out big subsidies, but it seems the electorate aren't any more convinced by those sort of tactics, and they want to see stronger growth rates and genuine job creation, which is what Modi's promise is, that he will deliver jobs growth and better economic growth.
Well, of course, Rajiv, you know he has a track record as a chief minister, a state government. What is his record portend for his central administration should he prevail?
He's had a very good track record in terms of economic management in his state of Gujarat, where he has been the chief minister. The growth rates in Gujarat have significantly outperformed the national average during his term of office, and he's been acknowledged for being a chief minister who's very capable of attracting new investment from multinationals, from Indian companies into the state, because he does deliver in terms of making things happen, projects implemented very quickly. He has an approach to getting things done within government so that land is allocated for new projects. One of his great achievements that people focus on is in a country where power shortages are one of the national characteristics and negative features of the country, in Gujarat they have a power surplus, which is really quite astounding, which just sort of highlights his ability to get things done. So I think these are the reasons why the broader electorate now are looking to his achievements in Gujarat and want him to bring those to the whole country. But if he does get a big mandate from the electorate, I think that will give him a lot of strength in his negotiations with some of the state governments to try to press ahead with key economic reforms.
Rajiv Biswas, chief economist at IHS Global Insight in Singapore. He says India's next leader must find ways to return annual growth rates to the 8 to 9% level to reduce poverty. Part of the challenge will be improving the country's energy infrastructure. Biswas says today, while having about the same size population, India has only about one-fourth the power generation of China. In other South Asian election news, Afghanistan's presidential vote is being held as a success, with 7 million voters braving Taliban threats to go to the polls. But as Sharon Bain reports from Kabul, Afghans say the true success of the election lies with the candidates accepting the results.
For one rare weekend, Afghans like Ismail Qureshi were happy. Standing outside Gold's Gym in central Kabul, Qureshi says the weekend presidential elections were a huge success. He says, this is a happy moment for Afghans. We have voted for a new leader. 95% of the people are happy that things were quiet and they cast their votes. It's good for our people, he says. About 7 million voters braved Taliban death threats to cast their ballots for a new president Saturday. U.S. President Barack Obama commended the Afghan people on Saturday's voter turnout for an election he described as critical to securing Afghanistan's democratic future as well as continued international support. The vote, says Andrew Wilder of the United States Institute of Peace, was a decisive message to the militants.
If 7 million Afghans turned out to vote, despite all these threats, I think there's only one way to interpret that as a real significant defeat for the Taliban.
But while the voting is over, the election process is not. Allegations of fraud have begun to come in, and the Taliban on Sunday attacked a convoy carrying boxes full of ballots to be counted. The election workers were killed and the boxes destroyed. Wilder, who was in Afghanistan for the vote, says officials need to thoroughly investigate all claims of fraud or the election will risk losing credibility in the eyes of the people.
There are areas where there probably was significant levels of fraud, and I think that needs to be investigated. But I personally, at this point, given the turnout figures, would be surprised if the fraud was at such a decisive level that it would have a major impact on the outcome.
If successful, Saturday's election will be Afghanistan's first democratic transfer of power from one elected leader to another. On the streets of Kabul, Abdul Habib says it's time his voice and that of all Afghans is heard. He says the candidates have to respect the vote of the people. The people voted despite very hard conditions. They came out and cast their ballots, and the candidates should respect the verdict of the people. The worry for now is that if the candidates start to squabble over who won, their fight could spill onto the streets, erasing Saturday's voting success. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Kabul.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. More than 1 week after an environmental protest turned violent in the southern Chinese province of Guangdong, accounts of the events remain contradictory. What witnesses saw and posted online is starkly different from what authorities say happened. Rebecca Valley has more for VOA from Hong Kong.
Residents in Maoming, a coastal town about 300 kilometers south of Guangzhou, took to the streets to protest a planned chemical plant they say will harm the environment and feed corruption. While their demands seem clear, there are many unanswered questions about what really happened after the march of more than 1,000 people turned violent. Accounts online say police used disproportionate force and beat some protesters to death. The government says it acted to safeguard public order and prevent the situation from worsening. Authorities also denied any deaths. Ying Zhang is a lecturer in media studies at the University of Adelaide, where she researches social media in China. She says the incident highlights how fractured media in China can be.
There are two different China. Now, one is the China lives on social media. The other is China from central, official state media.
Pictures uploaded on Weibo, China's Twitter-like service, showed injured people, including a man lying on the ground with blood on his face and clothes. Other pictures showed tanks on the street, as well as special force police charging the crowds. Zhang says not everything on Weibo is accurate, but distrust against the government and official media makes people more likely to believe the worst.
So if it is a rumor, now it has this sort of the ground or the basis of, for people to believe in this rumor, because people didn't trust the government, okay? And they assume this kind of thing would happen.
Yang Zhihui, an eyewitness reached by phone by VOA, says he ran into the protest after accompanying his wife to a nearby government office where she was due to take an exam. While waiting for his wife, he saw some protesters becoming increasingly confrontational.
后来,
He says that there were a few students, young people, probably in their 20s. They went to buy eggs and started throwing them towards the armed police. Then they began throwing bottles of water. This went on for about 20 minutes, Young says, and then the police charged on and started beating people. Young says he saw at least three people being beaten unconscious.
I
saw it with my own eyes, he says. In one case, a man was beaten and there was a lot of blood. He had been beaten so much that his head was almost cracked. Young says that the man wasn't moving, but police wouldn't let people near him. Chinese media are effectively banned on reporting independently about sensitive events such as protests. Newspapers based in Hong Kong have reported that after the clashes, authorities sealed off Maoming and have requested that journalists show special permits if they want to enter the city. On Thursday, the official People's Daily published an account debunking online rumors. The article said reports by Hong Kong media that the protests led to 15 deaths and 300 people injured were false. It also said the suggestion that the army had intervened was false. People's Daily reported the picture of tanks that made the rounds online was in fact years old and shot during regular military drills. Lee Segan is a professor of media and communication at City University of Hong Kong.
They want to portray some kind of picture. It is not a too big problem. Everything is under control. So that's the guiding line for the state media to deal with this kind of issue.
On Thursday, 4 days after the clashes, the government held a news conference with selected media. The local deputy security chief admitted that because of the chaos at the scene, police had accidentally injured some protesters. He denied reports of deaths, but said that 15 people had been hospitalized, four of whom are policemen. At the news conference, the deputy mayor said that the government will listen to the people's suggestions in deciding the future of the PX plant against which people protested. Lee Segan says that the government has realized that online voices can become louder than the voice of officials.
I learned that from many other incidents, the hot way. So now they change their strategy. They turn to that platform, try to let their own voice to be heard.
Yang Zhihui, the man who witnessed the protest, says he doesn't trust what local officials are saying. He says the central government should make an inquiry on what happened. Rebecca Valli in Hong Kong for VOA.
Malaysia has joined other Muslim nations in banning the biblical motion picture Noah, saying actor Russell Crowe's visual depiction of the prophet is against the laws of Islam. The chairman of Malaysia's Film Censorship Board said in a statement today that the movie could not be shown in the country because Islam prevents the visual depiction of any prophet. Noah is an important figure in Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. Some Christian organizations in the U.S. have also been angered by the film, saying the plot strays too far from the biblical portrayal of Noah. Well, thanks very much for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. I'm Sarah Williams. Please stay tuned for International Edition with Susan Yaki, coming up next.
Requests. Your
outdoor dedications, and interviews and performances by your favorite music superstars. It's Border Crossings. This is Larry London. Be sure to tune in every Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA or online at voanews.com. You've got control. Border Crossings, weekdays at 15 hours Universal Time at VOA.